Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Israel says it's far away from ending its war on Gaza, and it has full U.S. support to keep going. So is there ever going to be an endgame? Let's get to the bottom line. After a year of fighting between Hezbollah in Lebanon and Israel, a truce was finally reached, although it's still really touch and go. Outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden said he would now seize the moment and renew his push for an agreement on Gaza, which has been devastated by Israel over these last 14 months. But his administration also just vetoed a ceasefire resolution at the United Nations Security Council last month and recently approved a new $680 million package of weapons to Israel. We've seen this story play over and over again. Calls for ceasefire while Israel gets all it needs to keep the destruction going. So which America is it? The one that talks of peace or the one that's funding this endless war? And now with Trump promising, quote, all hell to pay in the Middle East, what's coming next? Today we're speaking with political scientist Stephen Zunis, who teaches U.S. foreign policy and Middle East politics at the University of San Francisco. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Let me just start with the news of the incoming president of the United States, who will be sworn in January. He has tweeted out on Truth Social, please let this truth serve to represent that if the hostages are not released prior to January 20th, 2025, the date that I proudly assume office as president of the United States, there will be all hell to pay in the Middle East. Now, President Trump, President-elect Trump, I should say, does not mention Hamas, but he's made very clear who he's talking about. But I'm just interested in how you see this punctuation point in the Israel-Gaza story that we've been seeing watch unfold for 14 months. What are your views?
I think Trump is taking, you know, to the logical conclusion, the way U.S. foreign policy has addressed Israel-Palestine for years, that this idea that using as much force as possible against the extremists while refusing to reward the moderates, you know, creates a situation where it just creates more and more resentment and more extremism. I mean, it's hard to imagine Gaza suffering any more than it has so far in terms of violence made possible by U.S. arms, by U.S. vetoes, by the policies of the Democratic administration. And so with the incoming Republican administration, it's really hard to imagine getting much worse. I mean, I think he has this naive sense of this kind of bluster and threat, so will somehow make Hamas more rational. And obviously, history has shown that's not the case at all. What's somewhat disturbing, especially since he didn't mention any names, is that when he talks about those responsible, he could very well be referring to Iran, because there are a lot of people in the U.S. Foreign policy establishment, especially in the Republican camp, who see Hamas as some kind of Iranian proxy. Now, Iran certainly does have proxies in the Middle East, such as the militia in Iraq and Syria, and it has very close allies, which is supported materially, you know, like Hezbollah, like the Houthis. But Hamas, you know, they're not that close to Iran. They're on opposite sides in the Syrian civil war. They have very different histories, ideologies, theological foundations, but nevertheless, they have received a limited amount of support from some factions within the Iranian regime. But for those who are targeting Iran, who are obsessed about Iran, and that seems to be those in Trump's circles, trying to tie them to Hamas and therefore use this as an excuse for increasing tensions there and possibly even going for war. I mean, that's one thing that's jumped out at me about that tweet.
Is there any real choice in American politics? Is there any substantial difference between the Democrats and Republicans when it comes to this Middle East crisis?
Well, the fact that there are senators, you know, like Van Hollen, who are speaking out, the fact that there were 19 Democratic and Democratic Alliance senators who tried to block the latest arms shipments to Israel, shows there at least there's some dissent within the Democratic Party. There seems to be very little dissent within the Republican Party, unfortunately. But I think about the legacy. I think this is a really important point. I mean, we look at President Lyndon Johnson, the civil rights legislation, the Great Society program. On domestically, he was probably the most progressive president we've ever had. But how do people remember Lyndon Johnson? It's Vietnam. I mean, that is his legacy. And I'm guessing that Biden, who's ended up having a more progressive domestic policy than many of us anticipated when he ran for office in 2020, that Gaza is going to very much hang on his legacy as well. Going back to the Vietnam analogy, though, one thing that was really striking in 1969, Nixon's first year in office, you suddenly saw a lot of Democrats in Congress and a lot of the more liberal mainstream that had supported the Vietnam War when Johnson was president, when it was a Democratic war, were finally felt like they could speak out against it. And there was a huge shift during that year. From newspaper editorials, you know, to the sense of the Democratic caucus in Congress to come out, and because they felt free to speak out. They felt uncomfortable about criticizing a president of their own party, particularly in an election year. And at this point, they felt more free to listen to the broad public opinion, which was already opposed to the Vietnam War, especially among Democratic voters, to speak out. And we could see a similar shift, not as dramatic, I don't think, but I think we will see more outspoken criticisms of U.S. policy towards Israel, which has up to now been a very bipartisan kind of affair. In terms of Trump, I mean, I think he really doesn't have a vision. I mean, almost every president has had some kind of vision for foreign policy. Trump has no vision. He's purely transactional, and which has gotten a lot of criticism from the right as well as from the left. But I think on Israel, it's very clear he's handing it over, you know, to these really hardline ideologues, these right-wing Christian, you know, fundamentalists who see God as some kind of cosmic real estate agent that believes the whole region should belong to Israel, as well as the most far right within the Jewish Zionist community. And so things can definitely get worse in that regard in terms of the policies of the United States. In terms of the actual how Palestinians are treated, I mean, will there be that much difference between a president like Trump who opposes Palestinian statehood and a president like Biden who says he supports Palestinian statehood, but has done everything he can from UN vetoes to unconditional aid to opposing recognition of Palestine to supporting Trump's so-called Abraham Accords to bypass the Palestinians and normalization. I mean, on a practical level, people in the West Bank will probably not feel much difference. And similarly, obviously, people in Gaza are not going to be that much different. But I think what about Trump's extremism? I think at least he can't pretend like Biden does that he is really trying to reach an equitable, just peace. And again, I think that might lead to a greater activism and greater challenges both within the Beltway and beyond.
I am interested in this. This belief that's beginning to propagate it, that the Palestinians are all terrorists and they all deserve this, and thus, you know, genocide is justified, ethnic cleansing is justified.
And we have heard that actually for many decades. I mean, this is certainly the worst single series of atrocities and war crimes that do indeed violate the genocide treaty, but this idea that they're all terrorists and you can't trust them with statehood and treating the entire Palestinian movement as its worst historical components, that's been going on for many decades. But one thing I would emphasize, though, is that this is not the first genocide the United States has supported. I mean, look at Indonesia and East Timor, for example, Pakistan and Bangladesh. Back in the 1980s, the Guatemalan junta and the indigenous peoples. I look at Turkey and the Kurdish population, particularly in the early 1990s. For that matter, Saudi Arabia's bombing in Yemen just a few years ago. So in certain ways, I think it's important to recognize that the United States has been quite willing to support the most horrific crimes if committed by an ally. And they would use the excuse of anti-communism, during the Cold War or other excuses, but this is in many ways not new. What does make it different, I think, is that most of those atrocities are somewhat under the radar. Most Americans didn't even hear about East Timor, even though, 150,000 or more people died in that small country. But this genocide is unfolding on people's cell phones. I mean, there's no denying what's going on. So in certain ways, this makes it even more inexcusable. And I think it's really bringing to a fore certain really important discussions, both on the moral and legal issues, but also in terms of how the United States is presented in the world. I mean, a lot of Americans don't realize, at least the Americans that don't travel abroad, how the hypocrisy and double standards of U.S. policy are, that we can correctly criticize the Russians for their war crimes, for their illegal invasions, occupation, annexation of neighbors, and yet the United States comes and defends Israel. And so there's also, just as there's some pragmatic voices within Israel saying, hey, this doesn't really support, help Israel in the long term. This doesn't live up to the moral values we supposedly believe in. You're starting to see more of these issues, even among mainstream strategic analysts, about the consequences of U.S. support for Israel.
Let me raise three features with you that I've seen in the terrain. I watch this conflict as best I can every day. Three big features that I think are different, folks out there. One, the development of permanent bases, what looked like to be a network of permanent bases by Israel in Gaza, particularly in North Gaza, up to 19 installations, as I understand it. Second thing, we're watching Israeli forces let gangs come in and basically dismantle and take the aid that's coming in on these trucks. And so that UN convoys that are coming in and trying to move aid are suspending them because of the Israeli forces not stopping these gangs coming, which is a second piece. And the third, which is really horrific for me, NPR reporting about sniper drones. So drones that are almost set up, as I understand it, to almost automatically fire indiscriminately on civilians, on people. There's stories of women who go near a window and they'll fire single shots. This is indiscriminate killing, not the targeting of a Hamas commander. But so these are three big features that I'm wondering, where is the outrage? Where is the concern? Because they're all designed to remove people and to create a really an ongoing occupation that Israel says it's not up for.
Yeah, this is really frightening. First of all, I don't think these permanent bases are going to have any more success than the 19 permanent bases the U.S. planned to put in Iraq after the invasion. You cannot have a forward operating base amidst a hostile population. Regarding the issues of the use of the drones and the other technologies for indiscriminate killing, and this is one of the most disturbing aspects of what we've seen over the past 14 months, including the use of artificial intelligence. And for example, where they would look at the phone contacts of some Hamas leader and go after them, no matter where they are, find the and without concern about the fact they may live in an apartment building with dozens of other families who have nothing to do with Hamas. I mean, the level. I mean, the war crimes here are even worse than I think most people realize. And eventually, this is going to come out. I mean, eventually there will be sort of the kind of questioning about what were we doing, supporting this kind of thing. I mean, I think this is going to be something that's going to be debated on a moral level, certainly, but also, in terms of a strategic level. How did they possibly get away with this with the support of the United States? And I think it's really, really important that we can't stop putting out the human element and all this, and that I think the very fact that we are in a more diverse society than we used to, that we have a sizable Arab American population, a Muslim population, that we have And also just a population that is more diverse overall, including people of color, people who are from the global south, that is harder to dismiss the Palestinians as some kind of other. That it's and so as a result, I really, really do think that there will be accountability someday, but the question is how many people are going to die in the meantime.
I want to ask you not about the cost to Israel for this, but the cost to the U.S. brand and the United States in the world, where not only its government, but even institutions like the Post are somehow, turning a blind eye to many of the atrocities that we're seeing, as you said, on our iPhones.
Yeah, it is quite striking. I mean, the ICC has indicted 67 people, and this is the first time ever they have indicted members of a key ally. And then all of a sudden, the U.S. opposes the ICC. And so it's pretty transparent what this is about. The United States believes the International Criminal Court should only go after those from governments we don't like, or from rebel groups or terrorist organizations or whatever we don't like. And I mean that, and this is a country that found itself, on the rule of law. That we should not distinguish in terms of a person's politics or political alignment in terms of their responsibilities under the law, and and the excuses the United States uses, Israel's not a signatory of the ICC. Well, Palestine is, and the court has ruled unanimously. They're very, very clear that therefore it covers war crimes committed from Palestinian territory or on Palestinian territory. And furthermore, the United States had no objections when Putin and other Russian officials have been indicted for war crimes related to Ukraine, even though neither Russia nor Ukraine are signatories of the ICC, nor were a number of these African countries where various warlords and tyrants have been indicted previously. I mean, if anything, the ICC has had a pro-Western bias by the very fact that until Putin was indicted some years ago, every single person indicted by the ICC was an African. And certainly virtually all these Africans indicted, I think, deserve to be indicted. But certainly Africa does not have a monopoly on war crimes of this proportion. So this is really an old story that we've seen before. The same kind of thing where the United States will talk about human rights abuses by Iran, but downplay them by Saudi Arabia or many, many other cases where the United States will repeatedly act like a certain international norms regarding human rights, regarding international law, should only be used as a tool against, for political, geopolitical purposes and not as universal principles.
We've been talking about Israel, Gaza, a little bit maybe in, what's been going on with Lebanon. But when you kind of now move to Syria, seems to have a full out civil war going on, raises interesting questions about what Iran, Israel and the United States want, because they seem to be concerned about what happens if Assad were to fall in Syria, which is a real change of tune. And you've got, I'm just sort of interested in the state of play of Iran's axis of resistance, whether that's even a thing anymore.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that even though Iran is opposing U.S. imperialism and Western imperialism, it's something of an imperialist power itself. And also a rather reactionary one, frankly. And the only reason that Assad is still in power right now, frankly, is because of support of Iran and Hezbollah, Iranian-backed group, and of course the Russians. Now the problem right now for the Assad regime is that Russia is obviously preoccupied by the Ukraine war. That's where most of their jet fighters and others that have been bombing Aleppo and other cities and during the earlier phase of the civil war have gone. Hezbollah, actually, obviously, had much of its leadership killed, and they're struggling to rebuild and trying to continue to defend Lebanon. Of course, many of their positions in Syria were bombed by Israel as well. And so this has given the opposition groups an opening. In fact, there's some indications that Al-Sham and the other rebel groups were only planning a very limited response to an airstrike that killed a bunch of civilians a couple of weeks ago. And when the Syrian troops melted away, they said, hey, let's see how far we can go. And they have continued to move forward. And so, you know, I think the international dimensions obviously are very important regarding Iran, regarding Turkey and Russia and Israel. But I think it's really important to stress that ultimately this is about the Syrians, and that the it underscores that more important really than the lessening support from outsiders for the regime is the fact that the Assad regime just simply does not have any credibility. The Assad regime is does not have the support of its own people, and it's that that is why, you know, that things are collapsing at least as much as the lessened foreign support.
I'm going to ask you one last unfair question regarding Palestine and Israel, which seem to have a lot of enmity for each other, at least in their leadership. Right now, how would you advise anyone to get out of the doom loop of the back and forth between Israel and Palestine?
Well, frankly, I think the most important thing is to change U.S. policy, because Israel would not be getting away with what it's doing were they not having the blank check from the world's number one superpower. When you have this unconditional military, economic, and diplomatic support by a government which also claims to be essentially the sole mediator in the conflict, obviously you're not getting very far. I mean, Israelis, like any people, you have a left and a right and a center. You know, people on the left, for moral or for pragmatic reasons, say, hey, Israel needs to make the necessary compromises for peace. On the right, for religious or nationalist or other reasons, say, no, we should control the whole area. We should keep going to war. But most Israelis are in the middle. And history has shown is when the rare times the United States has pressured Israel a little bit, Israelis have moved to the left in terms of their voting patterns and opinions. And when they feel like they have a blank check, they feel, hey, we have nothing to lose, you might as well go for broke, they tend to ally with the right. And that asymmetry in power will continue until the United States applies at least some kind of tough love or whatever to Israel, saying, you know, we're not going to continue giving you a blank check where you can commit these atrocities, continue this brutal occupation, and continue policies which are, you know, obviously horrific for the Palestinians, but ultimately don't provide you with the security that you desire either.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your candor, Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of San Francisco, Stephen Zunis. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.